and welcome to the fifth episode of the Associate and Affiliate Cricket Podcast. I'm Russell Dignan, and I'm joined, as always, by Andrew Nixon. Welcome, Andrew.
Hi, Russell. How are you, buddy?
First, some good news. We are now available on iTunes. I haven't put the link out generally, but it is on there if you do a little search. So that's good for people who like to listen on that and want to download it. Slightly shorter episode today. We're dealing with the first half of the round of Intercontinental Cup and World Cricket League Championship matches in the United Arab Emirates. We'll start by recapping the Afghanistan and Scotland fixtures, and pretty much be summarised as Afghanistan won everything.
Yeah, I was expecting it to be a lot closer than it otherwise was. I think Afghanistan thrashed Scotland in the Intercontinental Cup game, winning by an innings and five runs, and in the World Cricket League Championship, it was, again, Afghanistan were well on top. And similar in the 2020 games.
Yeah, the T20s, they won them by 27 runs and 7 wickets. They weren't completely dominant, but it's still a decent win for the T20. The first World Cricket League match, championship match, was 7 wickets, but with 97 balls remaining. And Scotland, I guess the problem with Scotland in that first game, and it happened a bit in the second as well, they left themselves very short in what they scored. They only made 199, and... But after 34 overs, they were 2 for 133, so they just didn't kick on.
Yeah, they had sort of they lost 2 wickets at 133, and then lost sort of 3 more at 140 odd. So they had a bit of a middle order collapse, and then never really recovered from there. And to only score 199 in 50 overs is pretty poor, really.
Yeah, on the other hand, they probably couldn't have stopped Narrows Mangle anyway. He was pretty amazing.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Unfortunately, I didn't get to see much of his innings because it was over by the time I got home for my lunch from work. But certainly looking at the scorecard and what I've seen since, it was a pretty impressive innings. And then Sami Ullachinwarri playing a good sort of partnership with him towards the end, scoring 55.
Yeah, I think I was going to say the last 10 overs, but they won in 33 overs. But in the last 10 overs that they were actually batting, Mangle was pretty much doing whatever he wanted with the bowling. Scotland, they used 8 bowlers and still couldn't find any penetration there. So it was a pretty impressive victory. The second one was much closer. Kyle Kutson made 133. But again, they fell away, Scotland.
Yeah.
They were 5 for 190, 40 overs gone, 593, and only made 259, which is... It's not a bad finish, but they probably should have made 280.
Yeah, it was the sort of the last 5 overs again where they just lost wickets rather than scored runs. And really in the last 5 overs you need to just try and score as many off. It sounds obvious, but you need to score as many runs as possible and just try and keep those wickets in hand, and they just didn't do that. They lost Kurtzer towards the end. Had he stayed in, maybe they could have kicked on, maybe made 280 and put a bit of pressure on Afghanistan.
It was a good chase back. They're never completely on top of it. They needed contributions all the way down the order, but they actually got them. Every single player scored, I think the lowest score is 21 by Gulbayan Nabi, and he was not out. So it was an interesting chase. Nabi was probably the finisher, and Shahzad at the start, really, and he went ballistic in the first couple of overs.
Yeah.
And... Yeah, I mean, Afghanistan, we were expecting it to be closer. The last game was reasonably close, but I don't think Afghanistan was really threatened. It was a very impressive couple of wins there.
No, I think the closeness of the game sort of flatters Scotland a bit. And if you take Kyle Kurtz's innings out of the equation, then the Scotland performance looks pretty poor. The next highest score after Kyle Kurtz is Josh Davey with 64, and then it's 13. He's in the third highest score, so there isn't much to the Scottish batting card apart from those two innings from Kurtzer and Davey.
Which is interesting to me, because actually if you'd asked me beforehand, I probably would have said that Scotland was probably the deeper side and Afghanistan was probably the one that had the better stars, but actually it was almost the opposite on the scorecard.
It seems that the bringing in all those county players with the Scottish parents haven't really helped Scotland as much as they thought it would.
Certainly didn't help them in the Intercontinental Cup game.
No, definitely not.
They were at one point 9 for 68. So on the first morning, it was after 24 hours. Isatullah Dalati took 6 for 57, and in the first innings, had 5 for 37 in the second. It was quite amazing, actually. I would never have expected to be that close, particularly since Hamed Hussain wasn't actually playing the ICAP match either. He was rested.
Shapur Zajan also not playing as well. So they're missing the two best pace bowlers and still, you know, got Scotland out very cheaply indeed. So Afghanistan obviously have strength in depth in the bowling department.
What more can we say about that match? We obviously didn't see it, but the top order of Scotland collapsed twice quite badly. I think that's the biggest and most surprising thing, in that they have these players, and a lot of them are county players, and except for Kutsu getting made 57 in the second innings, that's about it from the top order in terms of contributions. The only other contribution of any note actually crossed the board was Taylor, who made 48, batting down at 8 in the first innings.
Yeah.
Roll for 125 and 145 rolled. It was the first over of the third day. They got 6 balls in, and that was it. That's an amazing.
We almost didn't get the having the 2 I Cup games on at the same time as 3 Test matches, and that over not taking place. it was lucky they managed to come back for that second day, third day. Sorry.
One of the things that actually comes out of that, we'll talk about it later actually, so maybe I'll hold off on this question and get on to the other games that were played this week, which was the Ireland-UAE game, which again we're going to talk about next week, so we'll have someone from Ireland in the chat. But that was almost the opposite really, wasn't it? We have one two-day game where the average innings, even Afghanistan's innings was only 245, so the average innings was at 170. This game, they lost 20 wickets for the entire 4 days, and put on somewhere over 1,000 runs, almost 1,200 runs.
Yeah, I think Trent Johnson has described it as one of the flattest pitches he's ever played on. If you look at some of the photos, the pitch literally looks like a road. It's got a very sort of grey tinge to it. It looks like more like concrete than grass. So I'm not too surprised about the Ireland running up all those runs. Ed Joyce played brilliantly, 155 from 172 balls. He doesn't often score quickly, so it's pretty impressive. And Niall O'Brien, again out of character, a very sort of patient 126 off 234 balls. And then Porterfield scored a century in the second innings, taking him to, I think, 1,000 runs in the Intercontinental Cup. But in general, I don't think, you know, could have probably played for 7 days on that pitch and not got a result. So I think it was a bit puzzling why Ireland didn't enforce a follow on. I think from what I've heard, it was sort of pretty tiring out there. It was quite hot on the day. I think 35, 36 degrees throughout the entire day. I think Ireland just wanted to give the bowlers a rest. They consider the World Cricket League Championship games to be more important, because that gets them into the World Cup, obviously.
Yeah, I think that's probably a fair thing. I mean, Docker bowled 46 overs, so...
And apparently didn't get a single ball to turn, from what I've heard.
Yes. They played on the same... make sure that I'm right saying this. Sharjah, which was where the Afghanistan-Scotland games... WCL games were played. And so we did actually see that pitch before the thing, and... It was kind of shiny. The pitch they played the WCL games on was a very shiny looking thing, I guess. So it's not that surprising, having seen the pitch, that it kind of played a bit like that. UAE did quite reasonably well. Actually, at some point they were actually scoring too slowly that they would have actually been bowled out. If they hadn't have been bowled out, they probably still wouldn't have reached Ireland's score, which I'm not sure what would have meant for the point system. Since it's not, strictly speaking, a first innings lead if you haven't had a chance to bat.
I think the both first innings have to be complete for the points to be given for first innings.
It would have been interesting. You know, they were still batting. They're only 6 down at the beginning of the fourth day. But they were rolled over for 360 there. Kurram Khan made 115, Arshad Ali 95. both very experienced players.
Yeah, and both of them two scored incredibly, incredibly slowly. Both sort of a strike rate of less than 50. I think Arshad Ali, looking at the scorecard, he's 95, came from 271 balls, which must have been pretty painful to watch.
Yeah, actually, speaking of watching, there's something I didn't actually mention about the WSL games. It was fantastic, the crowd for the Afghanistan game on the Friday when that was obviously a day off work in UAE. They didn't fill the stadium. It was about half full, which is very impressive.
Yeah, I think the other half was actually closed. Had it been open, that would probably have filled up as well. Afghanistan always seem to attract a good crowd in the UAE, and especially at Sharjah, which is why it's their home ground, of course.
Which is great. I don't know if you have heard, but what the viewing figures on the ICC site were like.
No, I've not heard anything, but I can imagine it was quite big. I think it was actually on TV in Afghanistan as well. The stream was actually broadcast over the air in Afghanistan, so I can imagine there'd be quite a big audience there.
Which, again, is good for Associate Cricket. It means, if it continues, that they might be able to get advertising. It was strange watching a game with no advertising whatsoever.
Yeah, for me, it was a nice throwback to the days when the BBC covered Test cricket and I didn't have any adverts, so it was reminiscing for me.
There are two other games played. Canada and Kenya World Cricket League games were played. Kenya came on top both games. They won both by 6 wickets in the third last over. Their best performer was their 20-year-old Irfan Karim, who scored 65 and 112. But they weren't chasing big scores in either match.
No, 227 Canada scored in the first match, and in the second match they scored 253. Sort of similar in a way to Scotland. They just didn't quite make enough runs, and again with Canada it was only one or two performers in each match that sort of got a decent start. I think my prediction was 1-1 for this watch, this match, and Canada probably could have won one of the games. I don't think certain things gone their way, but in the end, Kenya were the much better team.
Yeah, I think on Canada's finishing it, I certainly, at times I've seen them recently, and obviously I didn't see these games, but the impression I'm getting from the scorecard was that they have a tendency to only have two gears. It's either slow or it's slightly better than slow. Okay, that's 6 and over or 3 and over. They don't have that ability to score at 8 and over without risk. They only slog, and when they're slogging, they just get out.
Yeah, I think this is a negative influence from Rizwan Chima to some extent. He is a slogger, and I don't think he's as good as his reputation deserves. I think I said on Twitter he's still picked on the reputation he got when he had that great innings against, I think, the West Indies when he made his debut. He scored sort of 80-odd in no time at all in a 2020 game. And when he comes off, he can score very quickly. He scored 55 in, I think, the second match. The second match. But these good performances from him are blips on an otherwise quite poor record. And I think his influence as the captain of the team tends to spread to the other players, and it's a negative influence.
Let's use those games as a way to start our general discussion today, which is one of the things I want to talk about is youth and selection, but also homegrown players and others. Canada and Kenya are both rebuilding, and they're both quite young sides for the most part. Canada in particular has, a few years ago, they set up their top order as being Kumar, Gunasekara and Patel, who are 20 and 19 and 21, I think, at the moment. Kumar was dropped for the second game, which is not a surprise if you look at his results. They're all three of them are averaging somewhere around 20. But it is a surprise given that they've put pretty much all their faith in those three for this entire period since the World Cup. And then probably before the World Cup, going into the World Cup, that they would be the future. They haven't really worked out, have they?
No. you know, again, they occasionally show some promise, but in general have been performing quite poorly. They've Canada made a decision after the 2011 World Cup to go completely towards youth players. They obviously, John Davison had retired, and they stopped picking the likes of Jeff Barnett and Ian Billcliffe, their players based in New Zealand, and so I've went almost completely towards youth. And I think there's a balance to be made between youth and experience, and I think Canada have got the have overbalanced a bit on the youth side.
Kenya's players, they're not quite as young. They're all in their mid-20s, and Karim's in his early 20s. So they certainly, they're not an old side, but they probably have a slight better mix of that youth and experience. But again, they've, like Kenya have actually struggled quite badly with their youngish side, particularly putting on scores and being consistent in putting on scores. Whereas Ireland have their youth players and they've performed extremely well for them. So there are a lot of young players in associate cricket that are going around, which is great. But are we seeing perhaps too much emphasis on the youth? Are their teams, and probably a better question is, what are they going to do, those two teams? Because they're actually becoming quite vulnerable now in a year's time, missing out on that World Cup selection, but also potentially missing out on the high-performance funding because they're struggling badly and the other teams are coming through behind them. Do they need to change tack? Can they change tack?
It's a hard thing to say, because you think your Canada could turn things around by bringing in the, you know, the more experienced players and the players with Canadian passports from overseas and try and heal the rift they've got with Ashish Pagai and Usman Limbada, who aren't playing but otherwise would make a good addition to this team. If they lose the high performance program funding, though, they're not going to be able to do that. They're going to have to rely on youth. But by the same token, losing that HPP funding means that they're not going to be able to develop the youth as well as they otherwise could. I think they currently use their HPP funding a cricket academy in Toronto. And if that funding goes, and that academy might go, and the production line may not be producing as many players as it currently is, but Canada are often sort of lumped in with the USA as picking only expats. But in actual fact, although most of the team, you know, the majority of the team were born outside Canada, they, you know, moved to Canada as kids and have learned the game there. So they are, you know, I think Rizwan Chima and a couple of others are part of a homegrown side. And losing that funding could lead them struggling. Kenya is a different situation because, you know, they have more of a cricket tradition in the country. Cricket is seen as a sport to play, whereas in Canada, it's a sport that tends to be limited to one community. And Kenya, I think, could bounce back. You know, they have, you know, before, you know, their run to the World Cup semi-final, of course, was before the high performance program really existed. So I think Kenya would probably cope with losing HPP funding better than Canada. Kenya do have some sponsors in the country, and they have the East African Premier League, in conjunction with Uganda, where the matches are televised and they get sponsorship for them as well. So I think Kenya would cope better with the loss. Canada, it could be the kick they need to actually change the way they're doing things to some extent. Because although they are producing these homegrown players, whatever they're doing isn't really working, and I think they need to sort of change that balance between youth and experience, as we were saying.
Talk about HPP funding. What should it be used for? What are we expecting? And probably more of the point, what are we expecting out of it? Because Tim Brooks wrote an article on Europe recently that sort of indicated that we aren't really seeing that many good results out of it. Kenya and Canada certainly haven't improved their position after the best part of 10 years of having a better funding. They're actually probably gone backwards on where they were. Now, to some extent, that is because they just don't have the players they used to have. And in fact, probably almost entirely because they don't have the players they used to have. But should we have expected, regardless of the problem of retirements, them to have improved because they have this funding?
I think we should. I mean, you know, Tim's been saying on Twitter recently that, you know, every sort of cent of the HPP money is supposed to be accounted for, but other people I've spoken to have said that is sort of quite right, widely thought that within the ICC that Canada are wasting their high performance money. It's rather than funding the development of players, it's more funding the current team. And I think the HPP funding is designed to make the teams more competitive to some extent, but it's given for a sort of 4-year cycle, well, 5-year cycle in this case, because of the change of date of the World Cup qualifier, but that's a 4-year cycle, and the World Cup is in the middle of that cycle. So it becomes, well, what do you do for the other 2 years? Are you preparing for the World Cup qualifier, or are you preparing, assuming you're going to qualify for the World Cup after that? So for the first 2 years, you know you're preparing to try and put together a good side for a World Cup. And in the second 2 years, it's sort of, well, what do we do with this money? We've got this money. What do we have to spend it on? And it could be that the ICC should maybe step in and say what they should be spending the money on, rather than just give them a chunk of money and say, spend it on whatever you want. But whether the ICC have the time to do that or not is an entirely different matter. But you're certainly, in the case of Ireland, it's helped. You know, you look at the Ireland team that played in the 2007 World Cup, the Ireland team that played in 2011, the Ireland team now. There's a clear progression, A, of relying more on homegrown players and less on the expatriate community, and B, of performance going up. You know, the Ireland of now is a much better side than the Ireland of 2007. And you see that also to some extent with Scotland and with the Netherlands as well. Netherlands are now concentrating more on youth than on the expatriate players. The expats still make up a good proportion of their national side, but the players coming through now are all homegrown players. But Kenya and Canada, we haven't seen that progression. As you say, in fact, they've probably gone the other way, relying more on homegrown players, but less, their performance isn't going up. And it's hard to figure out exactly where the problem is, because on the face of it, it doesn't seem that they're doing anything different, but the performance just isn't there. Maybe, you know, Ireland, Scotland and the Netherlands have invested their money a bit more wisely, but without getting a look at the accounts, we're never going to be able to nail it down, are we?
I never want to rule out, too, the possibility it is just bad luck. I mean, the players, the players that Ireland have come through just happen to be really very good, and that the players that have come through for Canada and Kenya just haven't actually stepped up. Now, I think that players at Canada are quite talented, that they do have the youth, but they certainly aren't improving in the same way that the Irish players are. And partly that is to do with the opportunities they have to play against better opposition, because the Irish players get to play in county cricket, and that's going to improve them. Or even if they're playing county seconds, that's improving them. The Canadian players have the improvement that you get by being able to use that high performance funding to make them professionals or semi-professionals or close to it. So they've got the time to actually work on the game, but they're still just essentially playing club cricket in Toronto. And actually almost all the squad, parent squad, comes out of Toronto in two or three clubs, but that's obviously not the same standard as the other players. And I don't think they're pushing themselves hard enough to improve that performance week on week.
Yeah, and I think another problem is with Ireland, Scotland, and to a lesser extent the Netherlands, teams touring England can come and play a game, play an ODI. But because the West Indian season doesn't run at the same time as the Canadian season, for the most part, teams don't come over to Canada to play an ODI against Canada. And maybe Canada need to use more of their HPP funding to fund those sort of matches, go and play. You know, they had a brief tour of Trinidad ahead of this visit to the UAE, and maybe when they actually go to, you know, use the funding to fund these visits to Trinidad and try and get games against the West Indies or the teams touring the West Indies. You know, I think a team touring the West Indies would probably prefer to play a game against Canada, you know, with Canada trying to beat them, than to play against one of the West Indian domestic sides or West Indian university side that really know they're not going to beat the tourists and often rest all the best players so they don't get injured for the domestic competition. I think the tourist sides would probably prefer to play against Canada. Canada could perhaps set up a base in the West Indies somewhere, similar to how Afghanistan have set up a base in the UAE.
So the other relatively good news in the past few weeks is that Scotland's got additional TAP funding. I think that had already been announced, but it's been confirmed, along with the Netherlands. Most of that funding that has actually ended up going to full members again.
It had been announced previously, but they sort of had the formal announcement and description of what they would be spending the money on for the West Indies and Zimbabwe. Now, the aim of this fund is to improve the competitiveness of the higher ranked associate members and the lower ranked full members. Zimbabwe, you can argue, certainly do need to improve their competitiveness. However, I question, they already get, I think it's more than $10 million annually from the ICC. And last year, they played in the World 2020, had a brief tour of New Zealand in February, and that was it. Their international program certainly isn't as heavy as Ireland's, and even within the region, they probably play less international cricket than Namibia do. And when it comes to the West Indies, the West Indies are the World 2020 champions. Why do they need to improve their competitiveness? And I can't understand. And they've got the most amount as well. You think the most amount should go to the team that needs to improve their competitiveness the most? Well, the West Indies really need to improve their competitiveness the least. You know, they're the world champions in 2020 cricket. And they've been given, I think, was it $3 million over 3 years, or $4.5 million even? And I just don't see why they need that money. And they're setting up their own, the Caribbean Premier League. So I assume they're going to be getting money from that as well. And it just seems that rather than try and improve associate members, it is going to that to some extent. It seems to be shoring up full members that perhaps aren't doing well financially, rather than in terms of playing ability. And that, I don't think that is what the fund was intended to do.
Yeah, the West Indies are an interesting financial case because their main problem is that they can't afford to pay the players they have because they're a small market. And those players can earn $1 million for 6 weeks in the IPL or something like that, and therefore they don't necessarily want to play for the West Indies. But this money that they're getting it's not going to be sufficient to cover that, because $3 million won't cover, over 3 years, won't even cover Chris Gayle's salary.
No.
And conversely, it's money that if you'd put it somewhere else, in any number of areas, bats for school kids or dreaming more games to encourage people to be able to watch it, or scholarships in Test Play Nations for associate kids, or just giving it straight to associate nations to build grounds and those sorts of things. It would certainly have gone a lot further than I think the West Indies can put it, given that how much money they already have, and that their main financial difficulty is not that they don't have money, it's that they have to pay most of their income to their players because their players are so expensive.
Another point about it is that we don't actually know what the West Indies are going to spend the money on. Every other announcement has been accompanied by a detailed breakdown of what they're going to spend it on. So for Ireland, it's setting up the interprovincial tournament, the 3-day, 1-day and 2020 tournaments, paying coaches and fitness experts and physios and all sorts of stuff. We'll probably talk about this with our guest next week. But West Indies just says they've been given this money to do what? And Zimbabwe is supposed to be investing it in an A-team program and improving their domestic competition, but they probably already have enough money to do that. But for the West Indies, there's nothing about what they're actually going to spend the money on. So every other country who's got the funding, we know exactly what the money is going to be spent on. The announcement has been accompanied by a full breakdown. And yet for the West Indies, the announcement is just, we've given them this money. And you have to wonder, well, you know, what are they going to spend it on? And like you were saying, are they just going to try and spend it on salaries? But it's not going to go that far. It's not help cover their touring program. I think that's perhaps even more than the money they're getting from that. And you know, but this all comes down to it is, do they really need to improve their competitiveness? And I think the answer to that is no. They are already competitive. Even when they don't have their best players, they still have a good production line. They're still producing, you know, world-class players.
And their competitiveness has been improving in the last couple of years anyway, which not necessarily for anything to do with money. I mean, this comes back to the HBP funding. Money isn't a be-all solution to actually improving players. It helps if you can turn a group of amateurs into a group of professionals, because that's going to give them time to focus on the cricket. And it'll help to give you coaches and those sorts of things. But there's not a step beyond that if you've already got that, which the West Indies already do, that's going to make them better. This is some really high-performance stuff that they want to implement, like such as the England has that they don't. But I don't think, I mean, that's a kind of marginal gain that I don't think we're going to, they're probably not at the point where the marginal gain is actually going to produce that much for them anyway. And certainly it's money that, as I said before, the money could go a lot further in other places than it could in the West Indies, I think. I feel.
Yeah, absolutely.
Zimbabwe, you mentioned how little they've played, that they in fact have gone more than a year, except for the World 2020, they went more than a year without playing any matches. They're a fascinating case study of the problems of test status. We did pick up this week, actually, the ICC website has listed ICUP games as being test matches, which is, or under the test match banner, which is nice of them, because we've been advocating for that for some time.
Yep.
We assume it's some sort of mistake. Zimbabwe, and they don't have a huge player base. They used to have, I think, about 20,000 players. But I'm reasonably sure that has declined, along with the population of white people in that country. And I don't think that they have more than about 10,000 now, although they have increased the breadth of their programs. So that makes them no bigger than most of the big associates. Their quality of performance, the manager of the performance program at the ICC was asked in by a tweeter, which wasn't you, surprisingly enough, whether Ireland was better than Zimbabwe.
Yeah, so he was asked, are Ireland better than Zimbabwe and possibly even Bangladesh? And he completely ducked the question on Zimbabwe and only focused on the bit about Bangladesh, and then pointed out, well, Bangladesh beat Ireland 3-0 in a 2020 series, you know, last year, but then, so what, you know, Bangladesh beat New Zealand 5-0 in an ODI series 3 years ago, but nobody pretends that New Zealand are a worse side than Bangladesh, as Paul is the occasionally. Yeah, and
two of them, right? Those games were on the last ball as well, eh?
Yeah, yeah. So I think two of those games went right down to the wire. And then Bangladesh lost to Scotland just after that. And I think they lost to the Netherlands as well. Yes. So, you know, you can't really read too much into that one series. It's, you know, it's one data point, as you had to say, in statistics. But he never mentioned, in his reply, he never even mentioned Zimbabwe. It's almost like, do they not really want to admit that maybe Ireland actually are better than Zimbabwe? Because if they do, it throws into the question the whole, well, why does Zimbabwe have test status and Ireland don't? I think this is part of the problem with this, with having an absolute limit on the number of teams that can play. Because there's always going to be that, if you limit it to, you know, X amount of teams, is the team ranked at X plus one capable of beating the team ranked at X? And in case of first-class cricket, Ireland are capable of beating Zimbabwe, of that I have no doubt, and they'd probably be competitive against Bangladesh, and maybe even the West Indies and New Zealand to some extent. They certainly wouldn't disgrace themselves. It was like the ICC don't want to even countenance that question. It's an awkward question for them to be asked, and I'm not surprised he didn't answer it, because it does open up these questions. And you know, it's the same with ODI status as well. With in the World Cricket League Championship, the games involving Namibia and the UAE are not ODIs, even though they're in the same tournament where every other team has ODI status. And you look at the table, UAE are currently sitting in fourth place. So you'd argue, well, surely if you know Netherlands, Kenya and Canada deserve ODI status, UAE do, because they're ahead of them. And then you sort of start breaking it down, where UAE sometimes lose to Nepal in regional cricket, so does Nepal deserve ODI status? There's always this, does the team just outside the cut-off point deserve it as well, because they're capable of beating the team that are inside the cut-off point? So the cut-off point itself doesn't really make sense. And in asking that question, it would have been awkward to answer without then getting into the discussion of, well, why can't Ireland play test matches? And, you know, I know my answer is, well, yeah, why not? Why not just play test matches? What would be the harm? There's a lot of people will come up with various sort of answers. I don't know, we could get into all of them, but they'll say, well, what's the point of... Someone asked me on Twitter yesterday, what would be the point in an England v Scotland test match? And I was tempted to reply, well, what's the point of an England v Australia test match? Because it doesn't seem like there is. They seem to be happening all the time. And
they make an enormous amount of money.
Yeah. And my answer was, well, firstly, it depends on the context of the match. If that's for the European Test Championship, then it was a lot of point to it. But in the end, there being no point to a match, why does that mean that Scotland shouldn't be able to play? The other thing is, if there's statistical records, you don't want the team but scoring up a player building up a big score against a weak team, and a lot of this comes down to, I don't want anybody to be better than Bradman or average better than Bradman or score higher innings than Lara, because those are the figures that are, because currently the record happens to sit with players who you can certainly say are the best. At one point, the world test, the highest individual innings in test cricket was Matthew Hayden's 380 against Zimbabwe. But you'd be hard pushed to argue that was a better innings than Lara's 375, which was the previous record. This statistical record argument then doesn't really make sense. Not to mention the fact that the reason Bradman averaged so much was because he was playing against weaker sides. He was Don Bradman. Any side with Don Bradman is automatically stronger than pretty much every side that's ever played the game. But if we will probably talk about this at a later stage. If you can have more teams playing, you can implement a better structure to international cricket, which would ensure that teams of widely differing abilities would not play each other on as regular a basis. You just take another sport, you've got soccer, where the Faroe Islands are an incredibly poor side, and when they play the top teams in Europe, they'll often get 7, 8, even 9 goals put against them, but they don't play them every time. When they play teams that are of similar ability, the matches are close. So if you can have a structure where the teams play of similar ability play each other more often, then these concerns over the record book don't really happen. I think these record books are a bit of a nonsense anyway. Nobody actually looks at an innings and looks at the record and thinks, well, that's definitely the best. Occasionally, is at the moment, Bradman's average, yeah, he's definitely the best player. But there would have been a time before Bradman where the player with the highest average wasn't necessarily the best player in the world. It was a player who got lucky in a couple of games. And currently, at the moment, I don't think Lara's 400 was as good as his 375. I think on an England tour of South Africa in 95, Mark Atherton scored 180-odd, batted for nearly 2 days to save a game, and that's probably a better innings than Hayden's 380. We don't judge things on just what's the highest, what's the lowest, what's the best. We don't say that is definitely the best. We look at the context of the performance, and I think that would be the case. If someone did score 500 against Papua New Guinea in a test match, we'd still say, well, yeah, yeah, it's a good performance, but it's only Papua New Guinea. These innings are better.
Probably say a couple of things about it. One is, of course, that we already do that to a large extent. You look at innings,
yeah.
An awful lot of articles will break down and say only the top eight sides.
Yeah. Often by the same people who talk about the sanctity of the record book. I know.
This is where it breaks down with Bangladesh and Zimbabwe, in that a lot of people will actually say, well, actually, they're not good enough to be test nations. We're going to pretend that there's some standard of what it is and isn't a test nation. And therefore, only the top eight should be, and then the good. I'm not sure to what extent the ICC actually thinks that, and to the extent that the ICC is not a disparate group of body that actually has a coherent idea of what this means. But I'm not sure to what extent they actually look at it, test status as a record book type thing, and not as purely just a monetary full member status type thing, and that test play nations are full members and there's no difference between them. And it's really just a voting and a monetary thing from their perspective. But what we've seen, particularly in recent scheduling, is that the two test nations that are generally disregarded by everyone else, which is Bangladesh and Zimbabwe, are actually now in a certain limbo, in the sense that they play one or two test match series against the good sides. They may go many years between playing the really good sides. They play the weaker sides slightly more often, but only in two match series because they make no money from them. And then they go months and months without any cricket at all and play less cricket than the nations that are below them, who are playing competitive and interesting matches, because they're stuck in this position where they're not playing the ones above them and they're not playing the ones below them. When really, again, this is the problem with the structure that, and why Zimbabwe's not played for a year, is because they've fallen so far away from the other test nations. They're now in a position where they're getting no cricket at all. They're getting less cricket than, to some extent, teams that are in WCL4 and things like that, because no one wants to play them in the test nations and they're not willing to play against the associate nations.
Yeah, and I think to some extent that is the fear of embarrassment. It was last year, Stuart Law, while he was the coach of Bangladesh, suggested that Bangladesh should play against the likes of Ireland and the Netherlands in four-day cricket, and found himself out of a job soon afterwards. And I don't think that was entirely coincidental. So there isn't the willingness to admit that you are at that level, because again, like with Tim Anderson's refusal to answer the question, it opens up some awkward questions about their status. Should they not perform well against the likes of Ireland?
Probably about the point where we can wrap it up, Andrew. We'll be back next week. There's a couple of very important fixtures now, the Ireland-UAE games. The table is really tightened up because of the wins by Kenya and Afghanistan. There are now five teams in the WCL that are on 11 or 10 points, and Ireland's only on 13. So that's all to play for in those last two rounds. It'll be starting to finish.
It's certainly looking that way. I think Ireland will probably beat the UAE in both matches. It's lucky they're limiting the overs if they're playing on the same pitch. And I think that will just about put Ireland in the World Cup. They'll probably need one more win after that. But certainly that second place in the World Cup is certainly up for grabs. Even sort of with their win over their two wins over Canada, Kenya have started to play themselves back into contention to some extent. The Netherlands and Namibia games in April should be interesting. Because the Netherlands may be missing... Well, certainly will be missing Ryan ten Descartes. He doesn't seem to want to play for the Netherlands anymore. Could be missing Alexi Kaveh because it's at the start of the county season. So
Namibia is quite a dangerous side too. Yeah.
Namibia's two wins from eight games is not a reflection of their standards. I think they are probably a better side than Kenya, and certainly up there with the UAE. So a couple of wins for Namibia there could well make things even more interesting. So I think those last couple of rounds, especially that last round, where every match is going to be streamed, are certainly looking like it's quite interesting. competitive and interesting ODIs that actually matter. What a radical concept.
Yeah. I think I actually watched the WC game instead of a test match the other day. I was appalled.
Yeah, I did as well.
There we have it. All right. Well, I'll talk to you next week, Andrew. Thank you very much.
Yep.